Today at Reader's Corner, Jonathan Spence, author of The Search for Modern China, and the speaker for the Honors College Distinguished Lecture Series on October 3rd.
In the Chinese case, with Mao, the will and the range and the skill of the individual had an absolutely extraordinary effect. In 1949, specifically, when Mao sort of announced the foundation of the People's Republic, China was bankrupt. It had suffered desperately in a number of wars in the 20th century. The need for obedience, the need for law and order, the need to both embrace capitalism and attack the weak side of capitalism. China is very much ambiguous about this.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. China has long been described as inscrutable, a country that is both exotic and difficult to understand. Today, the world's most populous nation is a major player on the international stage. Yet at times, China's actions continue to baffle outsiders unfamiliar with the country's long and rich history and its impact on all aspects of Chinese life. Today's guest, Jonathan Spence, is considered the world's foremost authority on Chinese civilization and the role of history in shaping modern China. He is the author of a number of books on China, including the bestseller, The Search for Modern China, which is used in college classrooms across the country, including here at Boise State. A third edition of The Search for Modern China was released earlier this year. Dr. Spence has led a truly distinguished career. He is the Sterling Professor Emeritus at Yale University, where he was named a MacArthur Fellow, and he has received 10 honorary degrees and a Guggenheim Fellowship. I'm pleased to announce that Jonathan Spence will be speaking at Boise State on Thursday, October 3rd, as part of the Honors College Distinguished Lecture Series. The title of Dr. Spence's address is China's Quest for Stability, The Rise, Fall, and Renewal of a Global Power, 1600 to the Present. The lecture begins at 7 p.m. in the Student Union Jordan Ballroom and is free and open to the public. You can find out more online at boisestate.edu. Dr. Spence joins us today by phone. Jonathan Spence, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob, for the chance to share some thoughts about China.
Well, the pace of change in China has been incredible, especially in these last few years. I just have to begin with the question of whether there's been any other era in China's history that presents the challenges this one does and where the pace of change is so rapid.
That requires a real kind of bird's eye view. But I think you can make a case for the fact that China is not an unchanging entity, but is some sort of echo of the past can be found again and again and again as we look at the span of carefully documented history. China is sort of waiting to be studied because there is such rich resources. And the excitement of teaching it and sort of researching China is in a way to see when major reform attempts were attempted in the past, whether they succeeded or not, which kind of social background did you have to be from to succeed? You know, what was the hereditary laws? What kind of government did you have? All these things are documented in China to at least 600 or so BC in the time of Confucius. So we have as much to work on as historians as we possibly could digest.
I noted in your introduction that you have that emeritus title, which means that you're looking back on this distinguished career of studying China. And you're also looking, I'm sure, at some of your young historians in the Yale History Department who may just be beginning their careers. What's the difference in resource material, in the way a historian would approach studying China for these young faculty coming aboard now, as opposed to what it was like for you trying to get information out of China, trying to get to China, trying to learn more about the past?
I would say it's absolutely colossal, the difference. In fact, you know, you have to sort of pinch yourself to make sure that you're on the right track, just because the awesome nature of the problem that we're trying to study here. But I came to the States from England in 1959, and I switched to Chinese studies just because I found it so fascinating. When I got to Yale University, they had a new program in place, and they were welcoming graduate students, and it only took me a few weeks in 59-60 to get completely fascinated. But the thing we must remember now, I think our listeners and also you and I just chatting together, is that in 59-60-61, the study of China itself was absolutely violently polarized. It was a total Cold War period. You had to be extremely careful in what you said and what you explored. China itself was closed to foreigners on the whole, certainly from the States, and had been ever since the Korean War. And in general, one found it almost like studying shadows. But what has not changed in a way, I think, is the sense of the deep challenges that China faces. Those were seen in a kind of revolutionary language in the early 60s. Now they are partly in the rhetoric of big business and internal security. As we've noticed probably, and I'm sure all your listeners would have been catching some news now, that foreign businessmen are also being brought in for questioning and for some cases actually being incarcerated while the questions are asked about their business dealings. I felt that is really an amazing reversal of the period in which we call the unequal treaties and so on, when it would have been the British or the Americans calling the tune. Now the government has made absolutely clear that it has the right to take in any foreigners for questioning, and it may indeed penalize them for what they didn't even realize were crimes.
You mentioned something about your days of studying China and you had to be careful in what you said. I assume you mean by that if you weren't careful and overstated or said something that the Chinese government didn't appreciate, what you might have access shut off to you as an historian seeking information out of China. Is that more open today?
It's a shrewd way to put it. I think it's true that sort of hung over people as a challenge. Partly there was just a great shortage of information, and we knew that the information we were getting was being filtered through the Chinese government very, very often. But there were a lot of other places to study China. For instance, Taiwan had vigorous programs, research programs. Hong Kong, though it was still controlled by the British then, nevertheless was regarded as kind of a major listening post for China. We had Chinese overseas. We had some former Chinese diplomats. But it was sort of people were politically cautious. I think the Chinese were aware of the fact that we were not quite sure, where we came down on this. You could be enthusiastic for the revolutionary if you wanted to be. But even so, you might be questioned either by Chinese or by other authorities as you tried to get your visa, as you tried to get transportation together. It was amazing now when there are dozens of planes every day going to Chinese provincial and national airports. And wow, when I first went there was almost no transportation. You had to actually walk into China to cross a bridge from Hong Kong, a kind of symbolic crossing of the bridge. Which would take you into the new communist state. And then every moment of your trip would be monitored by Chinese so-called support staff or research staff who would guide you into the right, what they considered the right settings for questioning of locals, if that was permitted, or sharing occasionally a meal in a commune. But anybody in China at that time would testify that you were surrounded by revolutionary slogans on banners hanging from the walls, and every moment was really, you felt polarized. The ambiguities of China's relations with the Soviet Union were just becoming apparent. Tensions were obviously getting enormously great, and China's internal revolution was obviously speeding up after what was called the Great Leap Forward, one of the most radical rural programs in human history.
You mentioned China's relationship with Russia, and boy, how things have changed when the new leader of China took over. His first trip abroad, I believe, was to Russia. What signs of change does that suggest?
China's relation with Russia has always been really complex. That China could, in fact, either negotiate directly with the Soviet Union or could use Eastern European or other countries to carry its message. And then the basic message in the early 60s was that China now was gaining prestige at the cost of Russia, that Russia was slowing down. Khrushchev was widely despised by Mao, Chairman Mao, and so you had to sort of choose which part of world history you were going to focus on and how China might appear in that context. I myself chose that period of history as a grad student. I want to sort of let us explore what China was like to some extent when it was already a powerful country, which was true in the 17th century. Russian foreign relations were an important part of China's history in the 1680s onwards, with treaty systems, with Russian business allowed in China when it was not allowed to other Western countries, trading countries. The Russians were allowed to have their own religious establishment in Peking, where other countries were not yet allowed their missionaries, only or with great restriction. China's horse trade was central to its economy because China had mounted troops, but they had very short supplies of horses. So the Mongols, dealing with the Russians as intermediaries, you know, led to a kind of a mutual interest, if you like, on China's northern borders. So in many of these ways, there's been an active contact between the countries. And that is still true. Russia remains sort of very much part of China's preoccupations about great power status.
You're listening to Jonathan Spence, author of The Search for Modern China. Well, the history of China that you chose to concentrate on, the 17th and the 18th centuries, that is the beginning of your book. The Search for Modern China starts in the 17th century with the Ming Dynasty. I don't think many people in Western civilization can really fully appreciate the advances of the Ming Dynasty, especially when compared to Western Europe at the same time. Help us understand what was going on. What were the advances of the Ming Dynasty in those days?
When Westerners began to really read about China and visit China, which was pretty much a phenomenon of the 17th century, as I said, they were deeply impressed. We think that China was often sort of mocked or belittled by foreigners, and that has been true at different times. But in the 17th century, when people started to go to China, there was a lot of to and fro with China, and there was a big glut for China books, as there is now, in fact. And that was already true in the 17th century. And as memoirs spread from China to Europe, publishing houses began to publish new books and more detailed books outlining China's governmental system, the imperial system, the bureaucracy in Peking, the provincial system in the different areas of China. All of these were now the kind of thing that intelligent people, educated men and women, would discuss. And the desire to sort of move on from China back into one's own culture was really one of the preoccupations in Europe. So we find people listing the good things of China in the 17th and 18th century and contrasting them with the bad things as they saw it in Europe, huge religious strife, massive political conflicts, deep, deep poverty, corrupt bureaucracy that was seen as a much better under control in China, and maybe we find that a bit ironic now. But China was seen as a law and order country by many foreigners at this time. And so the foreigners said, well, why can't we run our country? Why don't we have sort of foreign Confuciuses? You know, why don't we learn from China? China only began to get belittling remarks on a massive scale in about the later period of the 18th century. So it's a fascinating area in its own right of how to write about people writing about China. It does get a little bit repetitive in the sound of it, but in fact there is so much to study. It includes art, it includes decoration, it includes the tea that came in from China with so much fanfare and Chinese architecture. Pagodas were built in Kew Gardens in London. Palaces of the Prussian kings had Chinese motifs. The Russians under Catherine the Great had Chinese pavilions. You know, there was like a sort of an excitement about China that took a long time to be demolished.
But meanwhile, back in China, as missionaries found their way across the country, there were violent clashes at various times, weren't there?
Yes, they were. These are spread out, and it depends how we want to analyze them. But you had indigenous religious persecutions and movements inside China, and these could be, in some cases, based on Buddhist sectarian beliefs and so on. We had different Central Asian religions in some central areas. There were synagogues in China, as well as minarets. Not many people realized that you had both a Jewish and Muslim presence in China. You had all kinds of new ways of stretching your belief system. And China kept popping up into the story. And at intervals, as the state got jumpy about the nature of foreign religious groups, they began to flex their own muscles, their national muscles, out of Beijing and try and stop some of the religious fervor spreading through what they called heterodox or unofficial kind of means for spreading new moral values. And this led to some extraordinary violent and bloodthirsty clashes between the state and the individuals. Very strong in the 17th and 18th century, but it goes back in Chinese history for two millennia at least. But it was a tough place, and because the balance of payments was so bad, Westerners wanted much more tea, porcelain, and the sides of Chinese culture that were really hot in the stores and shops of the West. But China didn't want any particular Western products, and so Westerners had to desperately try and find things that the Chinese wanted to buy. And the tragic solution that they made, which of course has been much discussed by historians and by the Chinese people themselves, the tragic decision that the foreigners made was to sell opium, to sell narcotics to China, and to use the profits from drugs to buy the more legitimate trade items that would come back to Western Europe and then the new United States.
You're listening to Dr. Jonathan Spence. He is the Sterling Professor Emeritus at Yale University. He will be here in Boise on Thursday, October 3rd at Boise State University, where he's going to deliver a lecture. It's part of the Honors College Distinguished Lecture Series, and the name of that lecture is China's Quest for Stability, the Rise, Fall, and Renewal of a Global Power, 1600 to the Present. Dr. Spence, I wonder if we could focus for a moment on 1949 and the founding of the People's Republic of China. The name Mao Zedong is a name that I think most Americans remember or at least know from Chinese history. What role does that era play in what's going on today in China, the progress China's been able to make, a plus, a minus, still up for grabs? What's your thoughts?
Still up for grabs, maybe the correct one. It's colossally important, and the impact, even for those who believe in the, sort of the powerful echoes of human history. In the Chinese case, with Mao, the role of the individual and the will and the range and the skill of that individual had an absolutely extraordinary effect. But Mao's shadow now hangs over the system. The demand that at least lip service still be given to a revolutionary change, the need for boldness, the need for expansion, these kinds of things, the need for central control, the need for law and order, all these sides were in fact in Mao's pantheon of beliefs as well. So China has now moved way beyond Mao's range and sense of what foreign policy was available to him or to the country in those days. I think that probably the way the Chinese economy is going now, it's still moving away from most of the central beliefs that Mao had. But this idea of the need for obedience, the need for law and order, the need to both embrace capitalism and attack the weak side of capitalism, as that's shown through through graft and corruption of various kinds. China is very much ambiguous about this. They don't want to go back to the Great Leap Forward of the 1950s. They don't want to go back to the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. But they are very jumpy about what happened to their ideological center, particularly after Mao's excesses, as these are discussed in China pretty openly now. But it wasn't just Mao's excesses, but it was also the fact that he held the nation together when the odds against it seemed massive. China was in terrible shape in the 1940s. You mentioned 1949 specifically, which is when Mao sort of announced the foundation of the People's Republic of China. China was bankrupt. It had suffered desperately in a number of wars in the 20th century. It had lost all its infrastructure, its industrial infrastructure, to the terrible war with Japan. So Mao came in with a roar, as they say, and just on a huge sort of wave of emotion and a sense of China's past grandeur being something that China should now try and restore to the fiber of the nation, as it were. And it was really remarkable. That's why for Chinese, the regaining of control over Hong Kong and the same regaining of control over Macau and powerful inroads into Central Asia, these are, and ambiguity about Korea, these are all kinds of traditional Chinese foreign policy aspects that were very strong and they still are very strong. And Mao's shadow sort of hangs over most of these in different ways. But there's also a huge amount that's new. And so we can say now that China has grown past Mao and come out the other side, I think. But as any daily paper shows us right now, China is still very, very nervous about its wealthy entrepreneurial class, just as it's very cautious about foreign investment and the long history of what they see as foreign exploitation of China.
You mentioned the return of Hong Kong to China in 1997 as a vivid marker between the older China and the new rule. I wonder if you could describe for us what is the difference, if any, if somebody's traveling through Hong Kong or staying in Hong Kong today. Is there a visible, palpable difference between life in Hong Kong today and what it was like prior to the handover?
Hong Kong has changed immensely. I was first there in 1960, I guess, 59 or 60, when Hong Kong was just full of refugees from the mainland, which gave it a sort of political twinge. But under British control, there was a pretty heroic attempt, I think, to do new housing for the refugee populations that were flowing into Hong Kong from some of the what they regarded as the excesses on the mainland. But China, Hong Kong itself looked like a sort of really small time downtown. There was almost no high-rise building. There was very little. The harbor was much, much bigger because they hadn't started landfilling the Hong Kong harbor. When you went across into China proper at that time in 59, 60, 61, then you were actually suddenly aware that Hong Kong was a good bit more progressive than you'd realized, and that there was more, there wasn't political involvement much by the Chinese in Hong Kong. But the British were holding the lid down and also investing quite massively in Hong Kong's infrastructure. So it was seen as a possible model. Now, I don't think Mao would have seen it really as a model, but Deng Xiaoping would have seen Hong Kong, along with certain aspects of what they call the sort of developmental zones and so on in China itself, as having to borrow. The need China had now in the post-Mao era was to borrow the sort of the sides of Hong Kong initiative in terms of economic growth. And also educational flexibility, change, travel, more open economy without need for visas and this kind of thing. So Hong Kong seemed like, although it was colonially dominated, you could say, by the British, it also seemed quite a bastion of freedom for general political self-expression. And if you cross that bridge, as I said, you were in another world, a world in which the revolution was still on everybody's lips, whether they believed it or not. But so in Hong Kong now, you can say it's a little bit like Shanghai, but they're both just phenomena of urban growth and high-rise population density. And again, the ordinary problems of running a city of 25 million people, the kinds of things that the mainland is facing. Hong Kong is on a smaller scale, but it still faces these problems very squarely and is, I think, doing very well, as much as one can see from the outside.
Well, China just last March has new leadership. Xi Jinping took over in what is called the fifth generation. What does an historian who's looked back on this long history of China over the years have to say about a new leader and what direction this country may go based on your studies of the past?
Well, it's very difficult because you need to get into sort of mega history, you know, a large scale, long range, a vast kind of range of geographical variance and a huge population, 1.3 billion population. Xi Jinping, the president now and head of the Communist Party in China, he represents, I think, those who sort of were kids at the time of the early Great Leap Forward and into the Cultural Revolution. The big problem now, and in answer to your question, is what is the legitimacy structure that brings these leaders to the fore? You mentioned the fifth generation. That makes sense as a phrase, but exactly how did those members of the fifth generation get that power? Some are said to be so-called princelings, that is, they inherited the power from their fathers and mothers. To be a revolutionary from the old guard was a very good way to launch your career. But these became aging revolutionaries, and nowadays there's a whole generation of leaders that have almost no knowledge of Maoism. So we have quite a really exciting kind of attempt now to see who is going to last in this group of fifth generation. But the battle is going on right now. What's happening now is that power elites are rising and falling, that there are big shifts in important ministries, and Xi Jinping has very good liaison with people who are powerful in different areas of the government. But it's very hard to tell exactly what are the leadership qualifications for the current people in the highest office in China. It still seems to be a very secretive process and one that is not open to foreign inspection and with a lot of complex economic ramifications in China, because the stakes are so huge. This is we're moving into trillion-dollar economics now, which is not my field at all. But this is just a major, major position that is being held by one of the global leaders, but we still have no idea really what his power base is.
Well, Dr. Spence, we're delighted that you could join us at Boise State on Thursday, October 3rd, for your address, China's Quest for Stability, the Rise, Fall, and Renewal of a Global Power, 1600 to the Present. That lecture begins at 7 p.m. in the Student Union Jordan Ballroom. It's free and open to the public. In the meantime, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. The name of the book, The Search for Modern China, by Jonathan Spence.
Thank you very much.
Next week, Mike Brown, author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.